Between April of 1906 and January of 1913, Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung wrote over 350 letters to each other. They corresponded about psychoanalytic theory, about the burgeoning, contentious psychoanalytic movement and all its players, about strategies for converting the field, and about business in the form of organizing conferences and publishing important journals and papers. Throughout it all, they also spoke about their relationship as colleagues, as father and son, as mentor and heir, as rivals and betrayers. It is this last thread, that of their relationship, which we will follow this evening. The editor of the collected letters, William McGuire, sets the stage for this correspondence. In the years just before, Freud was in a state of what he more than once called splendid isolation. His career had been racked by frustrations. His collaboration with Josef Breuer had resulted in an important work, The Studies on Hysteria, in 1895, but afterwards the two became estranged. Entirely alone, he had embarked in 1897 on the self-analysis of his dreams and the self-analysis of his own unconscious, which led into the writing of The Interpretation of Dreams. As Freud's biographer Ernest Jones says, he regarded it both as his most significant scientific work, the foundation stone of his whole achievement, and as the work that brought him into the clear personally, giving him the strength to face a troubled life anew. Freud had built his practice seeing mostly neurotic and hysterical patients from the upper and middle classes in his private consulting room, and was in contact with a small group of those interested in his work. The first significant focus of interest in psychoanalysis outside of Freud's immediate circle in Vienna was at the Burghausle Hospital in Zurich, which was both an asylum for the insane and the psychiatric clinic of the Zurich University. In 1900, the newly graduated and recently married 25-year-old Jung arrived to begin his medical career, where he treated mostly lower and middle class patients who suffered from psychotic disturbances. With his colleague Ricklin, Jung began to conduct association experiments. He was excited to see that among many important findings, their work was offering direct clinical support for some of Freud's theories. Jung published his findings in the book Diagnostic Association Studies, and he took the liberty of sending a copy to Freud in April of 1906. Jung was 31. Freud was 50.
Dear Connie, many thanks for sending me your diagnostic association studies, which in my impatience I had already acquired. Of course, your latest paper, Psychoanalysis and Association Experiments, pleased me most, because in it you argue, on the strength of your own experience, that everything I have said about the hitherto unexplored fields of our discipline is true. I am confident that you will often be in a position to back me up, but I shall also gladly accept correction. Yours sincerely, Dr. Freud.
Freud returns the favor by sending Jung his newly published short papers on the theory of neurosis.
Dear Professor Freud, please accept my sincerest thanks for the present you kindly sent me. This collection of your various short papers should be most welcome to anyone who wishes to familiarize himself quickly and thoroughly with your mode of thought. It is to be hoped that your scientific following will continue to increase in the future in spite of the attacks which have been made on your theory. One might almost say on you personally. Your therapy seems to me to depend not merely on the effects released by abreaction, but also on certain personal rapports. And it seems to me that though the genesis of hysteria is predominantly, it is not exclusively sexual. I hope to send you soon a little book of mine, in which I approach dementia praecox and its psychology from your standpoint. With many thanks, very truly yours, C.G. Jung.
Dear colleague, your writings have long led me to suspect that your appreciation of my psychology does not extend to all my views on hysteria and the problem of sexuality. But I am delighted with your promise to trust me, for the present, in matters where your experience does not yet enable you to make up your own mind. Though, of course, only until it does enable you to do so. Even though I look at myself very critically, I believe I deserve such trust. Yet I ask it of very few persons. As you know, I suffer all the torments that can afflict an innovator. Not the least of these is the unavoidable necessity of passing among my own supporters as the incorrigibly self-righteous crank or fanatic that in reality I am not. Left alone for so long with my ideas, I have come to rely more and more on my own decisions, increasingly immersed in preoccupations that have become monotonously exclusive. This has given me a kind of resistance to being urged to accept opinions that differ from my own. You are probably aware that our cures are brought about through the fixation of the libido prevailing in the unconscious. This transference is most readily obtained in hysteria. Transference provides the impulse necessary for understanding and translating the language of the unconscious. Where it is lacking, the patient does not make the effort or does not listen when we submit our translation to him. Essentially, one might say, the cure is effected by love. And actually, transference provides the most cogent, indeed the only unassailable proof that neuroses are determined by the individual's love life. Yours very sincerely, Dr. Freud.
As momentum builds around psychoanalysis, there is much outcry against the theory, with many papers published against it from many different quarters. Jung, in particular, gives vent to his anger and frustration in his letters to Freud. Freud tries to temper him.
Dear colleague, if I may be pardoned an attempt to influence you, I should like to suggest that you pay less attention to the opposition that confronts us both, and not to let it affect your writing so much. The leading lights of psychiatry really don't amount to much. The future belongs to us and our views. Younger men everywhere side actively with us. I beg of you, don't sacrifice anything essential for the sake of pedagogic tact and affability, and don't deviate too far from me when you are really so close to me. If you do, we may one day be played off against one another. In my secret heart, I am convinced that in our special circumstances, the utmost frankness is the best diplomacy. My inclination is to treat those colleagues who offer resistance exactly as we treat patients in the same situation. Most sincerely, Dr. Freud.
A much-anticipated meeting between Freud and Jung happens on Sunday, March 3rd, 1907. Jung and his wife, Emma, travel to Vienna, where they are welcomed by Freud and his family, and where Jung attends a meeting of the Vienna group. Upon first meeting, Freud and Jung talk for 13 hours straight.
Dear Professor Freud, you will doubtless have drawn your own conclusions from the prolongation of my reaction time. Up till now, I had a strong resistance to writing because until recently, the complexes aroused in Vienna were still in an uproar. Only now have things settled down a bit, so that I hope to be able to write you a more or less sensible letter. I am no longer plagued by doubts as to the rightness of your theory. The last shreds were dispelled by my stay in Vienna, which for me was an event of the first importance. Yours gratefully. Jung.
Dear colleague, your visit was most delightful and gratifying. I should like to repeat in writing various things that I confided in you by word of mouth. In particular, that you have inspired me with confidence for the future, that I now realize that I am replaceable, as everyone is, and that I could hope for no one better than yourself, as I have come to know you, to continue and complete my work. I am sure you will not abandon the work. You have gone into it too deeply, and seen for yourself how exciting, how far-reaching, and how beautiful our subject is. Yours cordially, Dr. Freud.
Over the next months, Freud and Jung exchange many letters, speaking about theory, about the state of the movement, and about an upcoming conference in Amsterdam. Freud declines an invitation to speak there, but he encourages Jung to go and represent the cause.
Dear colleague, I know you are now in Amsterdam, just before or after your perilous lecture, engaged in the defense of my cause. It strikes me as almost cowardly that I should meanwhile be looking for mushrooms in the woods instead of fighting my own cause, or at least standing by your side. I take comfort by telling myself that it is better this way. You, as the other, the second, will be spared a part of the opposition that would have been in store for me. For me to say the same thing over and over would be mere useless repetition. You, however, are better fitted for propaganda. I've always felt there is something about my personality, my ideas and manner of speaking, that people find strange and repellent, whereas all hearts open to you. If a healthy man like you regards himself as an hysterical type, I can only claim for myself the obsessional type, each specimen of which vegetates in a sealed-off world of his own. Yours, Dr. Freud.
The conference in Amsterdam was a crucible for Jung. His lecture was cut short. The discussion of it was put off until the next day. He and Freud are vilified. As he describes all that befell him and their cause, he says,
"Whether the facts are recognized slowly or quickly, or are attacked or not, leaves me pretty cold. But pouring unadulterated sewage over everything that isn't approved of is disgusting. One thing that has filled me up to the neck at this Congress is a contempt bordering on nausea for the genus Homo sapiens."
Over the next month, Freud grows alarmed that Jung is not keeping up the correspondence. Jung replies,
"Dear Professor Freud, your last two letters contain references to my laziness in writing. I certainly owe you an explanation. One reason is my workload, which hardly gives me a breather, even in the evenings. The other is to be found in the realm of effect, in what you have termed my self-preservation complex." A marvellous expression. "And indeed, you know that this complex has played many a trick on me, not least in my Dementia Praecox book. I honestly do try, but the evil spirit that bedevils my pen often prevents me from writing. Actually, and I confess this to you with a struggle, I have a boundless admiration for you, both as a man and a researcher, and I bear you no conscious grudge. So the self-preservation complex does not come from there. It is rather that my veneration for you has something of the character of a religious crush. Though it does not really bother me, I still feel it is disgusting and ridiculous because of its undeniable erotic undertone. Most sincerely yours, Jung."
Freud's response begins with the salutation, "Dear friend and colleague." He later begins many letters simply, "Dear friend." Jung maintains the more formal, "Dear Professor Freud," throughout their correspondence.
"Dear friend and colleague, what you say of your inner development sounds reassuring. A transference on a religious basis would strike me as most disastrous. It could end only in apostasy, thanks to the universal human tendency to keep making new prints of the cliches we bear within us. I shall do my best to show you that I am unfit to be an object of worship. Yours cordially, Dr. Freud."
Over the next 2 years, Freud and Jung build their movement. They hold the first Congress for Freudian Psychology in April of 1908. Jung has to pressure Freud to speak. When the day comes, Freud speaks for 3.5 hours over his allotted time. They begin the very influential journal, the Yearbook, and then have to wrangle each issue, whose papers to include and not include, how to afford it, problems with publishers, and so forth. The International Association for Psychoanalysis is founded, with Jung as its first president. They also deal with all kinds of personalities, both friend and foe. Frenzy, Gross, Ronk, Fleiss, Adler, Steckel, Abraham, Bleuler, Jones, Briel, Mader, Binswanger, Honegger, to name a few key players. In August of that year, Freud and Jung are invited to visit America to give lectures at Clark University. On the voyage over, they analyze each other's dreams until Freud refuses, saying that he could not submit to analysis without losing his authority. Throughout these years, they talk passionately about their work with each other. They share cases, sharing ideas about the development of the theory, what they each find themselves drawn to, especially mythology. They stay current with the other's family events, the births of two of Jung's children, the illness of Freud's daughter, the vacations they take, and their exhaustion in the face of maintaining practices while writing, publishing, and struggling with their own personalities. There are also, of course, disagreements between them. And the seeds of differentiation, which were planted years before, even in their very first letters, begin to sprout shoots. Theoretical and personal discord arises in earnest around Jung's questioning of the libido theory. Jung suggests it is more inclusive of all life force, not just sexuality. They also tussle around the use of mythology in the theory. In a letter to Jung, Freud takes him to task for questioning the libido theory and then says, quote, "Apropos of mythology, I long for mythologists, linguists, and historians of religion. If they won't come to our help, we shall have to do all that ourselves."
Dear Professor Freud, I was struck by your remark that you long for archaeologists, philologists, etc. By this, I told myself you probably meant that I was unfit for such work. However, it is in precisely these fields that I now have a passionate interest, and I have the most marvellous visions, glimpses of arranging interconnections which I am at present incapable of grasping. It has become quite clear to me that we shall not solve the ultimate secrets of neurosis and psychosis without mythology and the history of civilization. Her embryology goes hand in hand with comparative anatomy, and without the latter, the former is but a freak of nature whose depths remain incomprehensible. It is a hard lot to have to work alongside the Father Creator. As ever, Jung.
Jung's marvelous visions and glimpses continue to captivate his mind, and he begins to work on what will eventually become his book, Symbols of Transformation. The first part is to be published in the Yearbook as Transformations and Symbols of the Libido. The ideas in this book become a battlefield between them. While Jung is immersed in his writing, things have heated up with Adler and Freud. In June of 1911, Adler and three others leave the Vienna Society, and by October of that year, six others have left as well. This is a tremendous rift in the psychoanalytic community. In October of 1911, Emma Jung takes up her pen and writes her own letter to Freud.
Dear Professor Freud, I don't really know how I am summoning the courage to write you this letter, but I'm certain it is not from presumption. Rather, I am following the voice of my unconscious, which I have so often found was right, and which I hope will not lead me astray this time. Since your visit, I have been tormented by the idea that your relation with my husband is not altogether as it should be, and since it definitely ought not to be like this, I want to try to do whatever is in my power. I do not know whether I am deceiving myself when I think you are somehow not quite in agreement with transformations of libido, You didn't speak of it at all, and yet I think it would do you both so much good if you got down to a thorough discussion of it. Or is it something else? You may imagine how overjoyed and honoured I am by the confidence you have in Carl, but it almost seems to me as though you were sometimes giving too much. Do you not see in him the follower and fulfiller more than you need? Doesn't one often give much because one wants to keep much? Do not think of Carl with a father's feeling. He will grow, but I must dwindle. But rather as one human being thinks of another who, like you, has his own law to fulfil. Please do not take my action as officiousness, and do not count me among the women who, you once told me, always spoil your friendships. My husband naturally knows nothing of this letter, and I beg you not to hold him responsible for it, or to let any kind of unpleasant effects it may have on you glance off on him. I hope nevertheless that you will not be angry with your very admiring Emma Jung.
Finally, Freud writes to Jung about symbols of transformation of libido. After a first few paragraphs mentioning nothing of the book, Freud writes,
"The reading for my Psychology of Religion is going slowly. One of the nicest works I have read, again, is that of a well-known author on the transformations and symbols of the libido. In it, many things are so well expressed that they seem to have taken on definitive form, and in this form impress themselves on the memory. Sometimes I have the feeling that his horizons have been too narrowed by Christianity. And sometimes he seems to be more above the material than in it. But it's the best thing this promising author has written up till now, though he will do still better. In the section about the two modes of thought, I deplore his wide reading. I should have liked him to say everything in his own words. Every thinker has his own jargon, and all these translations are tedious. Since you yourself are this author, I shall make an admission. It is a torment to me to think, when I conceive an idea, that I may be taking something away from you, or appropriating something that might just as well have been acquired by you. Why in God's name did I allow myself to follow you into this field? But most probably, my tunnels will be far more subterranean than your shafts, and we shall pass each other by. Yet every time I rise to the surface, I shall be able to greet you. I did only add a heartfelt address also to your wife and children. Yours ever, Freud."
"Dear Professor Freud, many thanks for your very nice letter, which I have just received. However, the outlook for me is very gloomy if you too get into the psychology of religion. You are a dangerous rival, if one has to speak of rivalry. Yet, I think it has to be this way, for a natural development cannot be halted, nor should one try to halt it. Our personal differences will make our work different. You dig up the precious stones, but I have the degree of extension. As you know, I always have to proceed from the outside to the inside, and from the whole to the part. I would find it too upsetting to let large tracts of human knowledge lie there neglected. And because of the difference in our working methods, we shall undoubtedly meet from time to time in unexpected places. Naturally, you will be ahead of me in certain respects, but this won't matter much, since you have anticipated by far the greatest part already. With best regards, Jung."
"Dear Professor Freud, you were really annoyed by my letter, weren't you? I was too, and now I am cured of my megalomania and am wondering why the devil, the unconscious, had to make you, of all people, the victim of this madness. And here I must confess, very reluctantly, that you are right. My last letter, especially the tone of it, was really directed to the father imago, which should of course be faced without fear. This thought never entered my head. I thought that, knowing the transference side of my father attitude towards you, it would all be quite clear and do me no harm. After I've thought so long before writing to you and had, so I believed, fully understood my own motives, the unconscious has now played another trick on me with particular finesse. For you can imagine how delighted I am to have made a fool of myself in front of you. I can only pray and hope that your judgment will not prove too severe. Lately, Carl has been analysing his attitude to his work and has discovered some resistances to it. I had connected these misgivings about Transformations of Libido Part 2 with his constant worry over what you would say about it. It seemed out of the question that he could have resistances to his own work. But now it appears that this fear of your opinion was only a pretext for not going on with the self-analysis which this work in fact means. I realise that I have thus projected something from my immediate neighbourhood into distant Vienna, and am vexed that it is always the nearest thing that one sees worst. Please write nothing of this to Carl. Things are going badly enough with me as it is. Emma Jung.
Unfortunately, Freud's reply to Emma is lost.
My dear Professor Freud, heartfelt thanks for your letter. Please don't worry. I am not always as despondent as I was in my last letter. I was afraid you were angry with me or had a bad opinion of me. That was what made me so downhearted, especially because my main complex was hit. Usually I am quite at one with my fate and see very well how lucky I am. But from time to time I am tormented by the conflict about how I can hold my own against Carl. I find I have no friends. All the people who associate with us really only want to see Carl, except for a few boring and, to me, quite uninteresting persons. Naturally, the women are all in love with him, and the men I am instantly cordoned off as the wife of the father or friend. Yet I have a strong need for people, and Carl, too, says I should stop concentrating on him and the children, but what on earth am I to do? What with my strong tendency to autoerotism, it is very difficult. But also, objectively, it is difficult because I can never compete with Carl. In order to emphasise this, I usually have to talk extra stupidly when in company. You will now understand why I felt so bad at the thought that I had lost your favour, and I was also afraid Carl might notice something. At any rate, he now knows about the exchange of letters, as he was astonished to see one of your letters addressed to me, but I have revealed only a little of their content. Will you advise me, dear Herr Professor, and, if necessary, dress me down a bit? I am ever so grateful to you for your sympathy. With warmest greetings to you and yours, Emma Jung.
Emma was trying to reconcile Freud and Jung, and at the same time shore up her relationship with Freud, with whom she had had a brief analysis. After these few letters, she wrote no more.
Dear friend, my work on totemism is going very slowly. I have run into all sorts of difficulties, rapids, waterfalls, sandbanks. I don't yet know if I shall be able to float my craft again. In any event, time alone will prevent us from colliding or clashing. I have very little time, and to draw on books and reports is not at all the same as drawing on the richness of one's own experience. Besides, my interest is diminished by the conviction that I am already in possession of the truths I am trying to prove. Such truths, of course, are of no use to anyone else. I can see from the difficulties I encounter in this work, that I was not cut out for inductive investigation. My whole makeup is intuitive, and in setting out to establish the purely empirical science of psychoanalysis, I have subjected myself to an extraordinary discipline. I am all in favour of your attacking the libido question, and I am expecting much light from your efforts. Often it seems I can go for a long while without feeling the need to clarify an obscure point. And then one day I am compelled to, by the pressure of facts, or by the influence of someone else's ideas. I should be very much interested in knowing what you mean by an extension of the concept of the libido to make it applicable to dementia praecox. I am afraid there is a misunderstanding between us. same sort of thing as when you once said that to my way of thinking, libido is identical with any kind of desire. In reality, I hold very simply that there are two basic drives, that only the power behind the sexual drive can be termed libido. Yours ever, Freud.
For several months, Freud's correspondences include, among many other things, annoyance and concern about how long Jung is taking to reply to his letters. Jung responds,
"Dear Professor Freud, I think I'm not wrong in suspecting that you rather resent my remissness as a correspondent. In this regard, my behaviour is indeed a little irresponsible, as I have allowed all my libido to disappear into my work. On the other hand, I don't think you need have any apprehensions about my protracted and invisible sojourn in the religious libidinal cloud, as you call it. I would willingly tell you what is going on up there if only I knew how to set it down in a letter. Essentially, it is an elaboration of all the problems that arise out of the mother incest libido, or rather, the libido cathected mother imago. This time I have ventured to tackle the mother. So please do forbear with me a while longer. I shall bring all sorts of wonderful things with me. Ad majorem glorium psychoanalysis. Most sincerely yours, Jung."
"Dear friend, what you say about my resentment of your tendency to neglect our correspondence worries me and warrants more thorough psychoanalytic elucidation. There can be no doubt that I was a demanding correspondent, nor can I deny that I awaited your letters with great impatience and answered them promptly. I disregarded your earlier signs of reluctance. However, this time it struck me as more serious. I took myself in hand and quickly turned off my excess libido. I was sorry to do so, yet glad to see how quickly I managed it. Since then, I have become undemanding and not to be feared. But as we know, irresponsibility is not a concept compatible with depth psychology. It would be a severe blow to all of us if you were to draw the libido you require for your work from our International Psychoanalytic Association. Yours ever, Freud."
"Dear Professor Freud, your letter has made me very pensive. I must own that I have never been able to rid myself of the idea that what I have done and still am doing to promote the spread of psychoanalysis must surely be of a far greater moment to you than my personal awkwardness and nastiness. If ever anything serious had befallen me that might have imperiled our work, it goes without saying that I would have informed you. I have my work cut out to put up with my own personality without wishing to foist it on you and add to your burdens. Whenever I had anything important to communicate, I've always done so. I have not kept up a lively correspondence during these last weeks because I wanted, if possible, to write no letters at all, simply in order to gain time for my work and not in order to give you a demonstration of ostentatious neglect. Or can it be that you mistrust me? Experience has shown how groundless this is. Of course, I have opinions which are not yours about the ultimate truths of psychoanalysis, though even this is not certain, for one cannot discuss everything under the sun by letter. But you won't, I suppose, take umbrage on that account. I am ready at any time to adapt my opinions to the judgment of someone who knows better and always has been. I would never have sided with you in the first place had not heresy run in my blood. Since I have no professional ambitions, I can afford to admit mistakes. As Zarathustra says, one repays a teacher badly if one remains only a pupil. This is what you have taught me through psychoanalysis. As one who is truly your follower, I must be stout-hearted, not least towards you. Most sincerely yours, Jung."
"Dear friend, why so pensive when the situation is so simple? You make it clear to me that you don't wish to write to me at present, and I reply that I am trying to make the privation easy for myself. Isn't that my right? Isn't it a necessary act of self-defense? during the transition to this attitude of reserve, I have complained very quietly. You would have thought me insincere if I had not reacted at all. Otherwise, we agree about everything. The indestructible foundation of a personal relationship is our involvement in psychoanalysis. But on this foundation, it seemed tempting to build something finer, though more labile, a reciprocal, intimate friendship. Shouldn't we go on building? You speak of the need for intellectual independence and quote Nietzsche in support of your view. Well, I am in full agreement. But if a third party were to read this passage, he would ask me when I have tried to tyrannize you intellectually, and I should have to say, I don't know. I don't believe I ever did. Adler, it is true, made similar complaints, but I am convinced that his neurosis was speaking in him. Why, I repeat, should you be so pensive? Do you think I am looking for someone else capable of being at once my friend, my helper, and my heir? Or that I expect to find another so soon? Rest assured of my affective cathexis, and continue to think of me in friendship, even if you do not write often. Yours ever, Freud.
Dear Professor Freud, like you, I am absorbed in the incest problem, and I have come to the conclusions which show incest primarily as a fantasy problem. The tremendous role of the mother in mythology has a significance far outweighing the biological incest problem, a significance that amounts to pure fantasy. Incest is forbidden not because it is desired, but because free-floating anxiety regressively reactivates infantile material. Just as it doesn't matter whether a sexual trauma really occurred or not, or was a mere fantasy, it is psychologically quite immaterial whether an incest barrier really existed or not, since it is essentially a question of later development whether or not the problem of incest will become important. This applies also to the incest taboo, which as a special psychological institution has a much greater and different significance than the prevention of incest, even though it may look the same from outside. Like the stones of a temple, the incest taboo is the symbol or vehicle of a far wider and special meaning, which has as little to do with the real incest as hysteria has to do with the real sexual trauma. Most sincerely yours, Jung.
Jung was arguing that just as Freud had abandoned his original hypothesis that hysteria was based on early sexual trauma, new evidence necessitated abandoning the theory that incest was caused by a fixation on early fantasies. Jung reasoned that since infantile fantasies are present in both neurotics and normal people, the cause of neurosis must come from a precipitating factor in the neurotic's current life situation. Freud and Jung agreed that when the patient fails to master his current life task, the energy needed to face those demands regresses towards an earlier phase of development, where it may find expression in sexual and incestuous fantasies. But Jung found that such fantasies often proceed past the sexual sphere, to themes of being swallowed and devoured. The Oedipus complex, with its urge for incest, changes at the deeper level to a Jonah and the whale complex, with a fear of engulfment. Jung posited that a regressive fantasy may continue all the way back to the intrauterine prenatal condition, or even further, landing outside the sphere of personal psychology altogether. Jung's idea is that the incest barrier developed not as a literal guard against sexual desire, but as a metaphorical guard against regressing back into the primal mother, into the original state of unconsciousness. And thus, for Jung, regressive infantile fantasies are not the cause, but the consequence of a failure to adapt to the current demands of life.
Dear friend, I finally see at what point your conception of libido differs from mine. I am referring, of course, to incest, but I am also thinking of your heralded modifications in the concept of the libido. But what I still fail to understand is why you have abandoned the older view, and what other origin and motivation the prohibition of incest can have. Naturally, I don't expect you to explain this difficulty in letters. I shall be patient until you publish your ideas on the subject. But if we now set reason aside and attune the machine to pleasure, I own to a strong antipathy towards your innovation. It has two sources. First, the regressive character of the innovation. I believe we have held up to now that anxiety originated in the prohibition of incest. Now you say, on the contrary, that the prohibition of incest originated in anxiety. Well, this is very similar to what was said before the days of psychoanalysis. Secondly, your innovation has a disastrous similarity to the theorem of Adler's. He said, the incest libido is arranged. In other words, the neurotic has no desire for his mother at all, but wants to provide himself with a motive for scaring himself away from his libido. He therefore pretends to himself that his libido is so enormous that it does not even spare his mother. Now this still strikes me as fanciful, based on utter incomprehension of the unconscious. And I have no doubt that your derivation of the incestuous libido will be different, but there is a certain resemblance. I repeat, I recognize these objections are determined by the pleasure principle. Yours, Freud.
Freud's inability to imagine any other origin of castration anxiety than the incest taboo resided in his theoretical conviction that anxiety is a derivative of transformed, that is, suppressed, repressed, libido. It is only more than 10 years later, in his paper, Inhibitions, Symptoms, and Anxiety, that Freud abandons this view and recognizes anxiety more broadly as a signal of danger. This move would open his theory to the dynamic importance of separation anxiety and annihilation anxiety that Jung was exploring years before. Freud, however, would never abandon his belief in the centrality of castration anxiety in the neurosis of male adults, nor more generally in the importance of infantile fixations of libidinous wishes as the dynamic nexus of neurotic symptoms.
Dear Professor Freud, on the question of incest, I am grieved to see what powerful effects you have mobilized for your counteroffensive against my suggestions. Since I think I have objective reasons on my side, I am forced to stand by my interpretation of the incest concept and see no way out of the dilemma. It is not for frivolous reasons or from regressive prejudices that I have been led to this formulation, as will, I hope, become clear to you when you read my painstaking and intricate examination of the whole problem in the second part of my book. The parallel with Adler is a bitter pill. I swallow it without a murmur. Evidently, this is my fate. There is nothing to be done about it, for my reasons are overwhelming. I set out with the idea of corroborating the old view of incest, but was obliged to see that things are different from what I expected. Most sincerely yours, Jung.
Dear friend, about the libido question, we shall see. The nature of the change you have made is not quite clear to me, and I know nothing of its motivation. Once I am better informed, I shall surely be able to switch to objectivity, precisely because I am well aware of my bias. Even if we cannot come to terms immediately, there is no reason to suppose that this scientific difference will detract from our personal relations. Yours, Freud.
While these intellectual and personal struggles accelerate, Jung is invited to lecture in New York at Fordham University. That same summer, Freud, Jones, and a few others consolidate the psychoanalytic movement in Vienna, leaving Jung out of the process.
Dear Professor Freud, I've just gotten back from America and hastened to give you my news. Altogether, the psychoanalysis movement over there has enjoyed a tremendous upswing since we were last in America. Everywhere I met with great interest and was favourably received. I gave 9 lectures at the Jesuit University of Fordham, New York, a critical account of the development of the theory of psychoanalysis. Naturally, I also made room for those of my views which deviate in places from the hitherto existing conceptions, particularly in regarding to the libido theory. I found that my version of psychoanalysis won over many people who, until now, had been put off by the problem of sexuality and neurosis. As soon as I have an off-print, I shall take pleasure in sending you a copy of my lectures, in the hope that you will gradually come to accept certain innovations, already hinted at in my libido paper. I feel no need to let you down, provided you can take an objective view of our common endeavours. I regret it very much if you think that the modifications in question have been prompted solely by resistances to you. With me, it is not a question of caprice, but of fighting for what I hold to be true. In this matter, no personal regard for you can restrain me. On the other hand, I hope this letter will make it plain that I feel no need at all to break off personal relationships with you. I do not identify with you with a point of doctrine. I've always tried to play fair with you, and shall continue to do so, no matter how our personal relations turn out. Obviously, I would prefer to be on friendly terms with you, to whom I owe so much, but I want your objective judgment and no feelings of resentment. I think I deserve this much, if only for reasons of expediency. I have done more to promote psychoanalysis movement than Rank, Steckel, Adler, etc. put together. I can only assure you that there is no resistance on my side, unless it be my refusal to be treated like a fool riddled with complexes. I think I have objective reasons for my views. Most sincerely, Jung.
Dear Dr. Jung, I greet you on your return from America no longer as affectionately as on the last occasion. You have successfully broken me of that habit. But still, with considerable sympathy, interest, and satisfaction at your personal success. Many thanks for your news of the state of affairs in America, but we know that the battle will not be decided over there. You have produced a good deal of resistance with your modifications, but I shouldn't advise you to enter this in the credit column. As you know, the further you remove yourself from what is new in psychoanalysis, the more certain you will be of applause, and the less resistance you will meet. You can, however, count on my objectivity, and hence on the continuance of our relations. I still hold that personal variations are quite justified, and I still feel the same need to continue our collaboration. I'm eagerly looking forward to an off-print of your lectures, because your long paper on the libido, part of which, not the whole, part of which I liked very much, has not clarified your innovations for me, as I might have wished. Your colleague, Freud.
In November of 1912, the International Psychoanalytic Association holds a conference in Munich. At one point, Freud and Jung take a walk, and they hammer out some things between them. Then, during lunch, as Freud complained to a group of colleagues about being left off the Swiss publications, he faints. This is indeed the second time Freud has fainted while in an emotional exchange around Jung, both times while engaged in a conversation about the overthrow of a father.
Dear Professor Freud, I'm glad we were able to meet in Munich, as this was the first time I have really understood you. I realize how different I am from you. This realization will be enough to effect a radical change in my whole attitude. Now you can rest assured that I shall not give up our personal relationship. Please forgive the mistakes which I will not try to excuse or extenuate. I hope the insight I have at last gained will guide my conduct from now on. I'm most distressed that I did not gain this insight much earlier. I could have spared you so many disappointments. I've been very worried about how you got back to Vienna, and whether the night journey may not have been too much of a strain for you. Please let me know how you are, if only a few words on a postcard. Yours sincerely, Jung.
Dear Dr. Jung, many thanks for your friendly letter, which shows me that you have dispelled various misconceptions about my conduct and encourages me to entertain the best of hopes for our future collaboration. Believe me, it was not easy for me to moderate my demands on you. But once I had succeeded in doing so, the swing in the other direction was not too severe. For me, our relationship will always retain an echo of our past intimacy. We shall have to lay by a fresh store of benevolence towards one another, for it is easy to see that there will be controversies between us. One always finds it rather irritating when the other party insists on having an opinion of his own. My attack in Munich was no more serious than the similar one in Bremen. The dining room at the Park Hotel seems to hold a kind of fatality for me. 6 years ago, I had a first attack of the same kind there, and 4 years ago, a second. A bit of neurosis that I ought really to look into. You're untransformed, Freud.
Dear Professor Freud, my very best thanks for one passage in your letter where you speak of, quote, a bit of neurosis you haven't got rid of. This bit should, in my opinion, be taken very seriously indeed, because I have suffered from it in my dealings with you. If your blinkers were removed, you would, I am sure, see my work in a very different light. Again, please excuse my frankness. It is only occasionally that I am afflicted with the purely human desire to be understood intellectually and not be measured by the yardstick of neurosis. I am forced to the painful conclusion that the majority of psychoanalysts misuse analysis for the purpose of devaluing others and their progress by insinuations about complexes, as though that explained anything. A wretched theory. Our analysis, you may remember, came to a stop with your remark that you, quote, could not submit to analysis without losing your authority. These words are engraved on my memory as a symbol of everything to come. With kind regards, Jung.
Dear Dr. Jung, you mustn't fear that I take your new style amiss. I hold it in relations between analysts, as in analysis itself, every form of frankness is permissible. I too have been disturbed for some time by the abusive psychoanalysis to which you refer. I do not know if there is any way of preventing this entirely. For the present, I can only suggest a household remedy. Let each of us pay more attention to his own than to his neighbor's neurosis. In one point, however, I venture to disagree most emphatically. You have not, as you suppose, you have not been injured by my neurosis. Very cordially, yours, Freud.
Since you have taken so badly to my new style, I will tune my lyre a few tones lower for the present.
I follow you with interest through all the variations of the lyre that you play with such virtuosity.
May I say a few words to you in earnest? I admit the ambivalence of my feelings towards you, but am inclined to take an honest and absolutely straightforward view of the situation. If you doubt my word, so much the worse for you. I would, however, point out that your technique of treating your pupils like patients is a blunder. In that way, you produce either slavish sons or impudent puppies. I'm objective enough to see through your little trick. You go around sniffing out all the symptomatic actions in your vicinity, thus reducing everyone to the level of sons and daughters who blushingly admit the existence of their faults. Meanwhile, you remain on top as the father, sitting pretty. For sheer obsequiousness, nobody dares to pluck the prophet by the beard and inquire for once what you would say to a patient with a tendency to analyse the analyst instead of himself. You would certainly ask him, who's got the neurosis? You see, my dear professor, so long as you hand out this stuff, I don't give a damn for my symptomatic actions. They shrink to nothing in comparison with the formidable beam in my brother Freud's eye. I am not in the least neurotic, touch wood. I have submitted humbly to analysis and am much the better for it. You know, of course, how far a patient gets with self-analysis. Not out of his neurosis, just like you. If ever you should rid yourself entirely of your complexes and stop playing the father to your sons, and instead of aiming continually at their weak spots, took a good look at your own for a change, then I will mend my ways and at one stroke uproot the vice of being in two minds about you. I shall continue to stand by you publicly while maintaining my own views, but privately shall start telling you in my letters what I really think of you. I consider this procedure only decent. No doubt you will be outraged by this peculiar token of friendship, but it may do you good all the same. Most sincerely yours, Young.
Dear Mr. President, your allegation that I treat my followers like patients is demonstrably untrue. Otherwise, your letter cannot be answered. It creates a situation that would be difficult to deal with in a personal talk and totally impossible in correspondence. It is a convention among us analysts that none of us need feel ashamed of his own bit of neurosis. But one who, while behaving abnormally, keeps shouting that he is normal, gives grounds for the suspicion that he lacks any insight into his illness. Accordingly, I propose that we abandon our personal relations entirely. I shall lose nothing by it, for my only emotional tie with you has long been a thin thread, the lingering effect of past disappointments. And you, apparently, have everything to gain. I therefore say, take your full freedom and spare me your supposed tokens of friendship. Yours sincerely, Freud.
Dear Professor Freud, I accede to your wish that we abandon our personal relations, for I never thrust my friendship on anyone. You yourself are the best judge of what this moment means to you. The rest is silence.
Really was the last bit of correspondence. There were a couple of business things for them to take care of, but the rest is silence is really true. And that was a long time for them to be silent after that. So, are we okay with this?
Yeah.
Great. So, do those of you who are our experts want to turn your chairs around?
Yeah.
And actors, you get to talk too. So, thoughts, feelings, arguments, questions? We'd like to kind of let this work on us. Yes, there was a hand up. Yeah.
Did Jung write about the time that the Second World War started, or even when Freud moved to London? Did he write about his exile once he moved here? So maybe not directly in a letter, but to somebody else or in his work?
Actually, Sona, you can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but they didn't connect again. But in, I think it was 38, Jung sent a cousin of his across the border secretly to try to get Freud out. And Freud said no.
No enemies.
No enemies.
I don't accept money
from enemies. And he was, you know, he had a place for him in Zurich. And so that was, you know, I don't know. So is there nothing more to say about that piece?
No, they didn't have contact.
Yeah, they didn't have any contact. Jung continued to write about Freud and Freudian ideas and his differences, and as he grew, his theory developed over the next years, always kind of in this vaguely reconciling way. I don't think Freud did much talking at all about Jung or Jungian theory after that. other thoughts, feelings, questions? Go ahead.
Just an observation. He talked about, Jung spoke about the Oedipus complex turning into sort of the Jonah and the whale complex.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting, I thought, maybe he's also some way referring to himself because he felt swallowed by Freudian pressure to reform.
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah. Well, it certainly was opening up a pull into an incredibly regressive place. Yeah, that's I'd never thought of that. That's useful. Yeah, yeah.
I actually do have a question. I don't know that much about Jung's personal life, but I heard that he actually had affairs with some of his the people, the women he analyzed. Mm-hmm. Whereas Freud was known to have always been monogamous, pretty much. So it's curious, though, that this guy's the sexual guy, and this guy all higher ideas than dirty sex. So I'm really wondering if, like, one thing was fulfilled by the other, and so they needed the other thing, really. Whereas Freud, I mean, as far as I know personally, he was always, you know, married, and there were never any issues in fidelity.
Yeah, I'll pass this on to the historians, but the Jungian theory is not up here. It's just as down and dirty. It just is a different point of view. So I don't want to let that characterization just float. But anybody want to talk about it?
Just because in the letter he said in America, you know, they like me because I'm not talking as much about sex. I mean, that's what it sounded like.
Yeah, but that had to do with the psychiatrists who he was talking to who didn't like anything about Freud. I mean, he was given a lot of hard times. So he was, his modification, that it wasn't that he wasn't talking about sex. He talks a lot about sex, actually, in the Fordham lectures. It's just not, he's modifying it. So, but what about the...
Can I just throw in a bit of a tabloid talk here? It's questionable whether Freud was quite as monogamous as you and many others have thought, because there's always been this question as to whether or not he did have a relationship with his sister-in-law, you know, as lived with them for a number of years. And I think it probably is one of those questions which we never... There is quite a serious question.
Is it not the case that Jung said something about what was said to him in the household when he went to visit the Freuds regarding the...
Yes, he did.
Sorry, perhaps you could... I just seem to recall that from reading.
Yeah, Jung reported to Belinsky, to John Belinsky, a professor of theology, that Freud was having... Menabenes confessed to him, Jung, that Freud was having an affair with her, and this was, in Jung's view, intimately bound up with his theories. I think one has to be careful here in terms of what is actually factually established and what is rumour and hearsay, and it doesn't, in terms of Jung, bulk of what is said about his supposed conduct with his patients is hot air, in terms of it's very little that's documented, but it is documented. It's been established that Freud did travel and check in to hotels, or at least one, with his sister-in-law in one room, as Mr. and Mrs. Freud.
There's also something to be said, I just add. These are men of a very different generation. You know, Jung was born in 1875. You know, Freud was born earlier than that, right? And we must be very careful that we honor them and their times and what they're about. They also didn't know about boundaries. You know, they didn't know anything. They were discovering this stuff. They were just learning what happened in a transference field and how wacky it could get. They didn't know that. So I don't mean to be Pollyanna here. I don't know if that's an expression in Britain, but, you know, we have to be careful. But go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, one of the most significant things about this correspondence that you can see, and it was very well shown there is that, you know, these guys are 19 years apart. And not only that, that's a very important 19 years in the 19th century. I mean, Freud was coming from this bio-evolutionary, rather scientific, trying to establish something in terms of the high science, which is bio-evolutionary science of his day. And he'd sort of moved on from that, but, you know, that's his heritage. And he is what? How old is he here?
It's 50 to 56. Yeah.
And you've got a young man here, 31 to 37. And the contrast is huge. And this young man, 31 to 37, is hugely influenced by the new critical philosophy of Nietzsche and people like that, much more so than bioevolutionary ideas. I mean, they're there, they're the sort of established science of the late 19th century. But, you know, there's this other critical philosophy which is criticising science, it's criticising various points of view coming from Nietzsche and other fellows around. And I think that makes a huge contrast. And lastly, I'd like to say, they don't mention clients or patients at all in these conversations. I mean, other letters do a little, but it's interesting how this is, they're leaving that to be spoken through, presumably, their publications up to a point, but they're not getting into that. And therefore, it's sort of left to be got into between each other, in a way. You know, exchanging this as soon as the patient, who's the analyst, who knows best about each other's neuroses, as it ends up here. That's just a few comments.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is the point that in much of the rest of the correspondence, they're talking about other people at the level of gossip, and they're often talking about other people and their sexuality. I mean, they do. But Freud said in the context of Otto Gross, he said, not repression, but healthy suppression. So that was his view. But he quite liked gossiping, I think, about other people's...
Well, very small group, certainly
in Vienna they were very small.
Right. Well, even the whole psychoanalytic movement, I mean, still today, right? Are we the largest group on the planet? No.
Yeah.
I want to add one more thing to this discussion, which is that Emma Jung was quite, I mean, they were quite forward in a certain way, they were forward thinking, because Jung did have a very long-term affair with Tony Wolfe, who was another analyst. And they, the three, made peace with that. And Jung never left Emma, Emma never left Jung. They were the primary couple, but there was a kind of almost, I don't know if the right word's bohemian, but there was a, this is another way that I'm thinking up picking up what Chris is saying, the difference in generation is a significant difference.
But that's quite conventional behavior for a gentleman in Zurich of Jung's time, to have a mistress who is known of and welcomed into the household. That's not an unusual factor at all at that time.
So, I have a question. So, did you mean to say that it was intentional that they kept their clients out of the correspondence?
There are some letters about clients. Often, there are... you know, I don't know what to do with this, what's your advice, you know, kind of supervision. Then they shared patients, right? I mean, somebody would see Jung and then he'd send them to Freud and Freud would send them back. I mean, so there's some of that. But not a huge amount, unless I'm misremembering.
No, except that in terms of the history, as this is more generally known, the so-called mutual analysis between Jung and Otto Gross is seen as being relatively important, and also he discusses that with Freud, and in the popular imagination, perhaps, that's the bit of the story that is most remembered, if inaccurately.
Yes, and it's interesting that Jung says he's getting so much from this guy, Otto Gross, in terms of his own development, whereas for Freud, Gross, because of his morphine and whatever addictions, seems to be a threat to the establishment of the psychoanalytic movement. So they have a very differentiated personal and impersonal relationship to different people, different needs.
I would recommend reading this book. It is fabulous. It's like a page turner. You know, you could skip over the minutes of the last meeting. But it's really, it's so beautiful. There are 360 letters, and they really are, They're wonderful, and they evoke the period and the time and the history. Yes, Anne.
Reading Jung was making it sound a little bit sort of, you know, Jung's rebel. Actually, when you're reading the letters throughout, except right at the end, Jung's tone is conciliatory the whole time. Freud, right from the beginning, is overlooking, or might say almost brushing under the carpet, any theoretical differences there are on the sexual issue, which is central to Freud's theory. And I think what you're saying, Chris, is absolutely bang on. What Freud's real focus is the institutionalization of psychoanalysis. And he's willing to overlook all kinds of things as long as the institution of psychoanalysis, his brainchild, is preserved. And until the end, whatever goes wrong between them clearly starts some years before. But even so, throughout, Jung's tone in the letters is absolutely conciliatory. This is not the rebel son, which he tends to depict himself as later, isn't it? Unfortunately, the rest is silence. In fact, wasn't the case. They did go on shooting little barbs at each other.
Well, they did. I mean, through, certainly Freud did.
Yes.
I mean, the history of psychoanalysis.
Yeah, absolutely.
1914.
Really,
he's already starting on suggesting that Jung is anti-Semitic.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
But if you actually look at the letters, look at the letters, there's no evidence for that at all.
No, not at all. It got to the point where Joyce refers to them as Dr. Tweedledum and Vienna, Dr. Tweedledee in Zurich. They're going back and forth with each other. And I think even in that late work, Answer to Joe, if you read that carefully,
but he's referring,
and that's being analysed by mainstream psychoanalysts as well as by Jungian psychoanalysts.
Right.
One other thing, there's a lot actually about patients in the correspondence. What's really fascinating is to read these two pioneers actually developing hypotheses about things like the hysteria, obsession with neurosis, paranoia. It's fascinating.
Well, I do, again, all the more, get it. It's hard to get here. We try to get it for the shop, but they're hard to get. But you can get them.
Congratulations to you. This is your brainchild.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. There was a question in the back. There was a hand going up. Yes, pencil going up.
Just building on what you said, it strikes me that in terms of the language exchange between the two, it's about the breakdown, the emotional breakdown between the two. I got the impression, I might be wrong, that Freud is not just appealing for institutionalization, he's using the word objectivity, and interestingly, Jung is almost mimetically appealing for objectivity in a subjective way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you look at the history of the two that thought that since this massive one, and I'm not sure it is massive. I think it's kind of very hard actually. But what's interesting is that in my field, which is to do with kind of philosophy, that in the kind of post-structural world, Derrida and so on, mm-hmm. there is this kind of loyalty to Freud, and it was still being played out that Jung was a traitor.
Yeah,
and too easy this kind of slippage that Jung was a proto-Nazi, when in actual fact, as has been pointed out tonight, Freud's language is pretty psychotic at times. So it's a projective decision.
They were really caught. Really caught. And, well, so no, you were going to say something.
Would you sum up the question?
That was a statement.
That was a statement. And I was talking in particular about,
Sorry.
He's talking various things. We could do a whole evening on that comment, but the objectivity and subjectivity and what's happened to our culture since then and how we understand those ideas. Both men were appealing to objectivity. They both had science behind them. They both had experience with their patients that proved their theories. They were both saying, I'm right, because this is what I experience. It's an empirical science. It's not just a theory. And therefore, we have to imagine that they both had hands on the same elephant, right? In terms of the blowing up of the thing and the Jung's this big betrayer, I mean, that has a long history. That really became other people's issues. And Sonu can speak to that, I think, much better than I can if you wanted to say a word or two.
Just a few general remarks I wanted to say. First,
okay.
I want just to thank the readers for their sensitive reading in terms of a nuanced reading. I actually don't agree with Anne Casement's point about the Act of the Red Room. I think it's called the rebellious cockiness. It's precisely also very pleasant guy to deal with at that stage. But in terms of the general reading correspondence, this has been a very misunderstood correspondence because it has been read in a largely decontextualized, dehistoricized, and partisan way. And just to make just a few remarks in that sense, that anyway, these are two figures that come from different intellectual traditions. The question to explain is not why their relationship ends, but how they manage to stay in the same room talking in the first place. And as you're saying, we spent 13 hours talking together, and one is able to drink and the other isn't. So this is a somewhat tense social situation. More significantly, there's a missing element in this, and the central figure, if you look at the citations that they're discussing, is the missing third, and that's Eugen Bleuler. And in many regards, Freud's relation with Eugen Bleuler and his fallout with Eugen Bleuler, likewise Jung's, are more significant for Freud and Jung respectively. Quite simply, that with Bleuler's departure from the psychoanalytic movement, there's a divorce between psychoanalysis and academic psychiatry. Bleuler is at this stage one of the major figures in European psychiatry. He's the director of the Berkholz team. So he's the first psychiatrist that is standing up and taking an interest in psychoanalysis, and it's introduced then as part of the medical curriculum. And Jung's utility for Freud is saying, I'm the one who's converted Bleuler. So he's saying, he's coming there. This is my prize. I brought my chief. Was I who converted him? And that's his utility to the movement. And it's Freud, it's Jung and Bleuler who at this stage in the psychiatric community far more internationally recognized than Freud. So people read it completely the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Jung is a junior figure in years, but in terms of his scientific reputation within psychiatry, it's Bleuler and Jung that are respected. If you read the psychiatric press from 1905 onwards, they say, look, Freud is a crack neurologist. We psychiatrists don't have to listen to him. He only had about two or three cases of psychosis, but anything that Jung and Bleuler are doing, and they've got numbers and experiments, we take that stuff seriously. So it's putting it on the map. And likewise, Jung's first ambition is to become a professor of psychiatry at the University of Zurich. And it's only his his departure from that that leads to a complete transformation in his own orientation. So just to give some examples of some of the wider context, that in a large case it's an institutional split between the Zurich school that walk out en masse against Freud's putting authority above truth. It's a split between two political movements, and that sometimes the emotional aspects, which are very rich, which are very colourful, I mean, Newsweek already called this when it came out the great shrink schism. But one should be careful not coming too caught up in the drama. It was very well brought to life. Yeah.
But another aspect of what you're saying is that it's so desperately important for Freud, with his Jewish coterie of Vaterlandists, to find a respectability in the German language world of psychiatry. So, I mean, there's this kind of personal relationship, and indeed erotic charge, which they talk about. Mm. But beyond that, overarching that, is Freud's desperate need to find respectability outside of his own little Jewish circle. You agree with that?
Yep, yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. They're setting out to conquer the world of psychiatry, and Freud knows he doesn't stand a chance without Euler and Jung. It's 100%.
I might just explain, you're the one who can't drink, because you're not allowed to drink if you are part of the hospital in Zurich. They're all teetotalers.
You lose his job.
You lose your job if you have a drink.
Yeah, did everybody get that? Euler was very, very insistent that anybody who worked at the Berkowski didn't drink. And so nobody got to drink, ever. And they lived there. There's a mistake in the images, because, you know, they were the two studies, right? That's Freud's study and Jung's study. And how interestingly they were set up the same, you know. It's sort of, when I came across those two, I was stunned. But the first ones, the first letters from Jung, he and Emma are living at the hospital. They live on the hospital grounds. They are right there at the Berkowski Hospital. So they don't live in that lovely house until about halfway through this. When Emma, you should know, was one of the richest women in Zurich, in Switzerland at the time. And, that's the myth. Okay, sorry, I just took you away your money.
She was serious, she was well off. Yeah, she was
well off, okay.
He married well into Switzerland, yeah.
Yeah. She also became, but I do want to say for Emma, who doesn't have much but was, I thought she nailed it when she said, why are you putting so much on Carl? She studied and did this work. She did a whole treatise on, what is it, the Grail?
Holy Grail.
You know, she was a significant person in her own right. She didn't just stay so upset. Yeah.
Well, it's not so much, no, it's not a comment, it's a question.
But speak into the mic.
It's about time, I think, that we ask the actors how they felt about the characters they were playing. How did you feel about Freud and Jung and Emma Jung? And how did you feel the relationship between you actually evolved over the course of this lessons?
It's quite a good, obviously coming from an actor's point of view, not a sort of analytical point of view, which I suppose does have some parts involved as well. But it's nice to play the love side relationship of it, because, you know, it does feel like a love relationship from beginning to end. I was thinking about lots of people said about Jung being quite an earnest character in the way that he would talk to people. But this was very much under a guise, you've got a letter to write, so you've got time to take what you want to say to someone. You can construct exactly what you want to say, and you can utilize your words into the most effect and with the most power. So what you're saying is the real epicenter of the thought or the feeling that you're sharing with that person. It's not like when they meet up with each other and talk with each other then, because you're quick thinking. So this was really the deep part of their relationship. It's quite nice to access that, I suppose, to see that.
Yeah.
when you think about letter writing as well, and
because you can compose, that's what you've
got to think about getting the paper, getting the pen going, getting the ink going. You've got to write it out, you look for an envelope, you're thinking about what you've written, and maybe they dash them off, I don't know, but I know letter writing is so different to our email sending and everything like that these days. And so, you know, it is so much more considered and so much more staying with you and probably till the next letter. And I wondered about this business, the gaps and the expectation that Freud was really wanting replies and Jung says he's very, very busy. But, you know, I don't know, is he not so keen on replying? I don't know. I don't know what we know about that. Mm.
Times he's not. Times he is very busy.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, that they didn't, you know, that was it. Letters were it, you know, and you want it back. You want to get your response back. I mean, we feel that way with an email.
But there's also
a text for a
text, right?
You think you don't get one back in like 10 minutes, but and you're waiting for 3 weeks for a letter.
Right. I do get the sense, and I could be wrong and I'm glad to be corrected, that Jung was pacing himself with Freud too. Mm. That Jung was like, wow, this is, well, you get the example in our rehearsal that would be like you and Robert De Niro. You know, like, do I say I wouldn't play it that way, Bob? You know, do I just kind of let it go for a while? Do I, you know, how do you, and then of course Jung just was going on his own track. And he'd been going on his track before he met Freud. So, and there were 5 children, and you know.
There's also the complexity of the other letters that these two guys are writing to other people about some of the same things at the same time.
Right.
Mm. Plus their professional relationships. Mm. The correspondence takes place at the time when all these people who've been very close to Freud in psychoanalysis are moving out. Mm-hmm. And he's got a very, very complex relationship in the hospital and his desire, you know, to make his mark. And, you know, there's
military service in there, 5 children, and that, you know. Do you have a thought for Emma?
No,
you don't need it, because you've got a mic. Right.
When we first met to read it through the first time, we talked a bit, because I thought it was really interesting. I think she's very interesting just as an actor and as a woman from that point of view of who she was at the time that she was writing. I think it's so easy to, because psychoanalysis and psychotherapy and all that seems certainly to me to be a very modern construct. And therefore sometimes I think in this and also in the Anna Freud readings that we did, it's easy sometimes to think of them within the context of our society today. And suddenly when you think, gosh, this was, you know, over 100 years ago, that she was writing. She was also very keen, as she mentions in her letter, to be seen, to keep up with Carl and to hold her own with Carl. And, you know, and she does, she becomes and is a very intellectual and driven person in that way. Which I think is, of course, there were great women throughout history. But from that point of view of picking up the pen to write Freud because things aren't as they should be between him and her husband, and she feels that this relationship is something that should be kept, and partly because of what they're doing is so exciting and innovative and interesting. She certainly, even though she doesn't have a lot to say, she certainly strikes me as in a way a very modern woman. I think that she's very,
because she took it up.
It's a great pity we don't have Freud's letter.
Yeah, I know. They don't have it. Maybe it'll come up. You know, I've been given the signal. But I do want to say one thing, which is, well, 2 things. I want to thank the actors, absolutely. And I want to thank our discussion leader experts for having the answers. And there's so much more.
I stand corrected that these letters don't say much about patients. But here's one where Freud is talking about patients. They're just coming back from holiday, and he says this: "Today I resumed my practice and saw my first batch of nuts again." now transmute the nervous energy gained during my holiday into money to fill my depleted purse. It always takes a week or two before they all turn up, and for a while there's enough resilience and alertness left for scientific work. So that's where he was.
I think you can't judge an analyst by their first day back after. Want to be quoted, thank you very much.
He used to take his patients around holiday, but that's the trailer.
Yeah, that's so
but I do want to get the last word here to say, to say thank you to Carol and the Freudian Dream. This feels like quite an important moment for Jungians to be invited to the Freud Museum to bring some of this work and these ideas in and to be received so warmly. And maybe we can keep this conversation going in useful and creative ways. So thank you.